Do I say good morning or good evening?
Good night.
Good night. So I used to saying good morning. It's good to see everybody. We have a number of visitors with us tonight, so we welcome you especially. If you're looking for restrooms, it's kind of a small facility. You'll eventually find it, but they're basically behind that block wall there, and you just follow the hallway along that line, and you should be able to end up there pretty well. We have two sessions tonight at 7 o'clock. And then again at 8 o'clock, there'll be Q&A afterwards. If you got a question, we have somebody who will be walking around with the microphone to hand it to you so that those who are, we're recording tonight and we're also live streaming, so for the benefit of those who are not able to attend, can hear the questions, we'll be passing that around. And then tomorrow morning, we'll be meeting at 8:45, kind of like a Sunday school hour from 8:45 to 9:45, and then our service starts at 10. And Dr. Kruger will be our guest speaker for the sermon tomorrow as well. So we're going to make the most of this opportunity we have with him, and we appreciate him coming. And actually, I'm going to have Denny come at this time and give it like a formal introduction so we can appreciate the standing this man has to speak on the subjects that he's going to be talking about.
Well, that could take all night. We're happy to have Dr. Kruger with us. He is, if I get this right, Samuel C. Patterson, Chancellor's Professor of New Testament Studies and Early Christianity. It's a lengthy title, you know. I should have written it in the palm of my hand. He's written a number of books. Many of you are familiar with several of his books. We've done in groups here the Heresy of Orthodoxy, and I think I did have one on the canon revisited it at one time, but he's written a whole host of material dealing with early Christianity, the development of the canon, textual criticism, and he's done recently a book called Religion 101, preparing your kids to go off to school and face the sort of challenges they're going to get in their standard college challenges to Christianity. When he went to University of North Carolina, I think he encountered an unknown Bart Ehrman at that time. At the other end, he took his doctorate from underneath Larry Hurtado, and many of you are familiar with Hurtado's work. Fascinating stuff to read if you haven't read any of it. So he's going to be speaking on the development of the canon, and we're very happy to have him here. So let's give him a round of applause.
Well, good evening, everybody. Great to see you. Thanks for coming out tonight. Thank you for that introduction, Denny. I just got off the plane like an hour and a half ago. In fact, we were just joking on the way in. We're thinking that we hope that flight's on time. I was at another event. I was telling them at the University of Arkansas just a week or two ago, and when I showed up, the flight was not on time, and as a result, I had to put on the microphone in the car on the way to the event, and I'm in the front seat getting it all ready to go, and out of the car, on the stage, speaking right away, so at least I had an hour and a half to catch my breath here, so we got a chance to grab dinner and get a little bit oriented before we got to dive into today's material. But it's a thrill to be with you. I'm excited about the weekend, excited about the topics before us. As was mentioned, the overall theme of the weekend is well known. We're going to be talking about why we can trust the Bible and why it's something that is reliable and worthy of our belief and assent. But what I'm going to do this weekend is actually going to divide that up into little small chunks for you. And so I'm going to look at sort of what I think are three of the biggest objections to the Bible's reliability. And we'll just take those one at a time. And then we'll end the weekend, or at least my part of the weekend, tomorrow at the sermon. And what are the three biggest objections that you'll come across? Well, I think they're obvious, but we'll see them in the order of my talks. The first one's going to be sort of the historicity of the Bible and whether it's historically trustworthy. And we'll be looking at the Gospels in particular about that. And then secondly, we'll talk about the transmission of the Bible, whether it's been reliably copied, passed down by scribes over time. Has it been corrupted? Has it been changed? Has it been edited? That's really the second major objection. And then in the morning, for those of you who are able to come for the Sunday school class at 8:45, we're going to be talking about the canon of the Bible even more narrowly, and who collected these books, and why were they put together, and who did it, and when did it happen, and can that process be trusted as well? So basically, it's biblical reliability, biblical transmission, biblical canon. Those are the big three, and then I'll be preaching in the service tomorrow on Hebrews chapter 4 about the Word of God being living and active. So it's an exciting chance to dive into these really important topics. I'm thrilled you're able to come out tonight, and hopefully you'll be able to come out tomorrow. Also, let me mention this, and it was said in the introduction, we're going to have some time for Q&A tonight. This is actually one of my favorite parts, because I don't want to merely have you hear from me. I want to hear from you. What's on your mind? What are you wondering about? What is tickling in the back of your mind in terms of the trustworthiness of the Bible? And so you'll have a chance to interact with my material tonight when we deal with Q&A on both of the two talks. And then, of course, I'll be up here individually afterwards for further conversation if you want to do that. Okay, that's our plan. Let's dive into the first of those tonight, which has to do with the reliability of the Scriptures, in particular, the reliability of the Gospels. And to kick off our first session, I actually want to start in a rather unusual spot, probably a spot you would not expect, because I want to begin by talking about Muhammad Ali. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, that's the weirdest start ever to a talk on the origins of the Bible. Why are we talking about Muhammad Ali? Well, we're not actually talking about Muhammad Ali the boxer. I want to talk about Muhammad Ali the shepherd, probably a Muhammad Ali you've never heard of or thought of before. But in 1945, Muhammad Ali the shepherd, a little town in Upper Egypt called Nag Hammadi, made what might be one of the greatest archaeological discoveries of the modern world. In fact, believe it or not, just on the plane today, on the way here, I was reading in a book that was articulating this discovery and said, yes, this might be the greatest archaeological discovery in the modern world. What did Muhammad Ali find? Well, one day he was out in his field. He was a shepherd. He was a farmer. He was digging in the ground for this certain soil that would have been useful for fertilizer with his brother. And his shovel hit something hard. And then he began to clear away the dirt and discovered something that was something like out of a movie. He found an old earthenware jar. And he began to wonder what was inside of it. So he was about to break it open, thinking maybe there's jewels or gold or silver or treasure, which would make any sort of poor shepherd's life change dramatically. And about the moment he's about to break it open, his brother stops and goes, wait a second, maybe there's an evil genie inside that'll curse us. So they have a big conversation about evil genies. And they debate this back and forth. And finally they decide, okay, we're going to risk the evil genie. We're going to break open this jar. And so they break it open. And when they do so, they're profoundly disappointed, because there's no jewels, no gold, no treasure. All that's in the jar are books. And if he were to have counted them, he would have realized actually there were 13 of these books, 13 what we call leather-bound codices, in which were multiple stories. In fact, 52 different stories inside those codices, all about Jesus. And he had discovered not just stories of Jesus, but stories of Jesus that up to that point, no one had really ever heard before and never really had been discovered before. And the Jesus in these books, if only Muhammad Ali had realized it, told a very different story of the Gospels that you and I are familiar with. We think of Jesus as one who's the divine Son of God, but in these books, it's not so much that Jesus is divine, but that you and I can be divine. And if you read these books, it's not so much that you're saved from sin or from trespasses. If you read these books, you're really saved from lack of enlightenment, and that you just need to have some higher form of knowledge. What Muhammad Ali had found was what later became known as the Gnostic Gospels. Now, if only he had known, because he ended up selling it to an antiquities dealer, who sold it to another antiquities dealer, who sold it to another antiquities dealer, and only till later down the road they realized, oh my goodness, he has found basically a lost collection of stories of Jesus. And inside those Gnostic Gospels was one particular gospel that became the most famous. It's probably one that you've heard of, and some of you may have even read at some point, known as the Gospel of Thomas. Muhammad Ali, the shepherd, made what is arguably one of the greatest archaeological discoveries in the modern age. Why? What was so special about it? Well, when scholars found these books, they began to ask the same questions that probably you're asking even tonight as you hear the story, which is, well, what do you do with lost stories of Jesus anyway, and why did these not make it into our Bible? And by the way, who decided what books go in our Bible? And why should we trust Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as opposed to, say, the Gospel of Thomas anyway. And by the way, weren't there other Gospels aside the Gospel of Thomas? Wasn't there the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of Judas and all these other Gospels? And why would we think our Gospels are anything special? And what if things had gone differently in history and we'd ended up with other Gospels in our Bible? Aren't they all pretty much the same anyway? Those are very big questions. Because whichever gospel you trust and read is going to tell you what Jesus you should know and believe in. So a different gospel means a different Jesus. And that's really what's at stake in this whole discussion. And that's really what changed the landscape of the study of the gospels upon that discovery of Muhammad Ali. Now, here's what I want to do in our first session tonight. I want to basically deal with why our gospels are in our New Testaments as opposed to gospels like the Gospel of Thomas. I want to ask the question, is there any reason why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John made it in our Bibles as opposed to these other texts? Are these other texts just as valid? Are they just as good? Are they just as important? Do they tell us true things about Jesus, and maybe we wish we had those in our Bibles? That will be our topic for tonight. So basically tonight I'm going to give you what would be called sort of a miniature case, a small apologetic for Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and why they're special. And of course I'm going to make the case that they actually ended up in our Bibles for a reason, that they're not arbitrary, they're not randomly there, they're not just the choice of some political faction within early Christianity, but that actually there's a real common sense historical reasons why we ended up with these Gospels in our Bibles as opposed to something like the Gospel of Thomas. Now that's our goal in this first session. Before we jump into that formally though, I want to step back for a moment. And I actually want to ask a more broad question when we think about the story of Muhammad Ali and the Gospel of Thomas. And then that question is, why is it that our world is so fascinated with lost Gospels anyway? I think that's important to ponder for a moment, because I think once we answer that question, it's actually going to set the stage for our discussion about what makes our Gospels important and what makes them distinctive and unique. Now, you may not have thought much about it, but actually it is true that our world is fascinated with lost Gospels. There's so many titles out there now about lost Gospels, forgotten scriptures, lost Bibles, all with the theme of some hidden secret text that's now been discovered, and now you can know what Jesus is really like. And if you write a book about a lost gospel, you're bound to sell lots of copies. And if you write a book about our Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you'll probably sell a lot less copies. I actually happen to know this because I write about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And not about the Gospel of Thomas. And I can tell you that if I were to write about these other Gospels, I'm sure I'd sell a lot more copies of my books. Every once in a while, I think to myself, maybe I should just write a story about the Gospel of Thomas and sell a lot of books, and then later say, just kidding, that's not really what I wanted to write about anyway. But regardless, what you realize is our world is absolutely mesmerized by this sense that maybe we've been misguided this whole time, and that maybe now we're finally learning what Jesus is really like. What is it about that question that grips people's imaginations? I want to suggest to you that it's not random that the stories of lost gospels have proved so fascinating in our postmodern age. If you don't know anything about the current cultural moment we live in, it's often known as postmodernity, which comes after modernity. And if you think about it, modernity was an age where everyone wanted to prove things by science and by facts and by historical arguments, and then the postmodern world came around and said, wait a second. In postmodernity, there's a recognition that there's so much disagreement about theology and philosophy, about God and the Bible and about truth, that what postmodern people like to talk about is the diversity of views out there, the diversity of opinions about every issue you could possibly talk about. And usually there's a lot of discussion about how many different religions there are and how many different perspectives there are and how many different philosophical takes there are. And by the way, that's true. There are a lot of religions. There are a lot of opinions and there are a lot of philosophical takes. But what you'll notice about postmodern sort of individuals and postmodern people is they don't just merely observe the existence of intellectual diversity. They draw a conclusion from it. And it's actually that second step that we don't notice. It's not merely look at all the different religious views. It's not merely look at all the different philosophical views. A conclusion is drawn from that, and that conclusion is one you hear all the time, which is, if there's so much differences of opinion about religion, then no one view could possibly be right. It's that second step that is often made and slipped into the argument in a way that is not ever justified. Everyone agrees there's lots of philosophical opinions. Does it follow from that, that not one view could possibly be right? Well, according to postmodern people, yes, that's exactly the point. By the way, you can see how important that is for our discussion of lost gospels. There's so many different gospels out there. There's so many different views of Jesus out there. There's so many approaches to who Jesus was out there, then no one gospel could possibly be right. No one gospel is any better than any other. Now, there's a scholar that famously made that argument many years ago, and you probably never heard his name. In 1934, a German scholar by the name of Walter Bauer wrote a very famous book called Orthodoxy and Heresy in Early Christianity. And in 1934, when Bauer wrote that book, no one noticed. It was totally lost in obscurity, and the reasons are not hard to discover, because in 1934, in Germany, no one was talking about Walter Bauer. In 1934, everyone was talking about this other guy named Adolf Hitler, and so he wrote his book, and no one noticed. But then in 1971, it was translated into English. And suddenly, everyone in the academic space began to take notice of this book. And you know what Bauer argued? He basically argued that when you look back in early Christianity, there's no such thing as early Christianity. In fact, he said that all you have in the early phases of the church are early Christianities, plural. All these different versions of the faith, all claiming to be original, all claiming to be genuine, all claiming to be orthodox, all very different from each other, all having a big theological battle about who really is the original version of Christianity and who is actually the right version of Christianity. So there's not just one version, according to Bauer. There's many versions. And then on top of that, Bauer says, and each of these different versions of Christianity have their own gospels. They have their own books. And you know why you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in your Bibles? Not because they're any better than any other gospels, argues Bauer, but because they happen to be the books that preferred by the group that prevailed, the group that won, the group that succeeded and conquered all the other groups, theologically speaking, and became the dominant version of Christianity. In other words, according to Bauer, the reason we read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is just an arbitrary accident of history. It's just the random occurrence of events. If another group had won, you wouldn't be reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You'd be reading Thomas, Mary, and Philip. And you wouldn't even know the difference. To put it more succinctly, Bauer's argument is that all gospels are the same. That none are better or worse than any others. And that you happen to read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but there's nothing about them that makes them any different than any other gospel. Now, that whole backstory I just gave you, which is how this debate fits into our postmodern age, is the story you will have heard if you're taking any major religion class. I wrote a book a few years ago that Denny mentioned called Surviving Religion 101. It's actually for college students. And I mentioned that in the book, which is you're going to hear this narrative that all gospels are the same. There's none better than another. Don't prejudice by saying one's right and one's wrong. They're all just equally valid. Could have been Gospel of Thomas. Could have been the Gospel of John. There's no differences between them. Now, that story, that narrative plays really well in a postmodern world. And I suppose if you don't ever examine it, it sounds pretty persuasive. Maybe gospels all are the same. Maybe there's no real reason why we should think that ours are better than anybody else's. But that narrative only works if you don't look at the historical facts. If you look at the historical evidence, you quickly discover that actually there are very good reasons why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are in our Bibles as opposed to other gospels. So that brings us back to the point of our first talk, which is I want to give you those reasons. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to lay out four reasons for you for why our Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, what we call the canonical Gospels, actually have made their way into our Bibles for very good reasons. These are four things that set our Gospels apart from every other Gospel out there. Now, when I say there's four reasons, I'm not suggesting there's only four. Actually, there's many more that I'm going to mention for you tonight. But these are four reasons I think you can wrap your minds around, four reasons that you can grasp, four reasons you can take away. My hope is, of course, that as you hear these four reasons, you think to yourself, okay, I personally now know I have a reason I can trust these books. Okay, that's good. But my hope is not merely that you personally take something away. My hope also is that these four sort of talking points, if you will, can be things you can bring up to somebody. If you ever get in a conversation with them and they say, well, what makes the Gospels and our Bible any better than any others? And you can say, well, I at least have something to say now in response to that. Okay, four things that set our Gospels apart. Let's take these one at a time. And here's the first. Our Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are the earliest Gospels we have. They are the earliest Gospels we have. Here's the thing that is true for all historians of antiquity. All the historians of antiquity realize if you want to know what happened in the ancient world, there's really only one way to know. Somewhere, someone wrote things down. It's just that simple. You can learn a little bit from archaeology, and I'm not suggesting you can't learn anything from archaeology, but in terms of the particulars of a person's life and what they did and what they said and what they were like in various ways, the only reason you know anything about anyone in all of ancient history is because someone, somewhere, wrote it down. That's what history is. There are words written down about what took place. We have thousands of historical documents about countless events in the ancient world. But when historians evaluate these historical documents, there's always something they want. They want to find an historical document that was written as close as possible to the events it's purporting to record. This is just common sense history. If you have an event and someone wrote down what happened in that event, you want the thing that was written down to have been written down at a time as close as possible to the events it's purporting to record. That's true for any document of antiquity, it's true for any event in the ancient world, and it's also true for the Gospels. So if Jesus lived in the first century, which he did, and we want to know what Jesus said and did and what he was like, wouldn't you want documents that are written in the very century in which Jesus lived? Or put it another way, wouldn't you want Gospels that come from the first century? Certainly that is common sense, and if you were to create your sort of ideal Gospel, you'd want a Gospel from the time in which Jesus lived. Not a later century, but the very century in which he did these things. Think about it for a moment. Let's imagine that you had a Gospel that was, say, from the 4th century. What if someone wrote a Gospel in the 4th century and says, let me tell you all about Jesus? You might think to yourself, okay, I suppose that person could get some things right. I guess it's possible they could record some things accurately. But if someone's writing in the 4th century, you think to yourself, well, what do you know in the 4th century anyway? And if I were comparing a Gospel that was written in the 4th century from a Gospel written in the 1st century, wouldn't I not think, at least all else being equal, that I'd rather take the Gospel from the 1st century? Well, let me tell you this. If you want a Gospel written in the century in which Jesus lived, there's only actually four options for you: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And here's what's remarkable about this. There is a consensus now in modern scholarship that these are the only Gospels that date from the 1st century, and that all of them date in the 1st century. Now, there's some disagreement over the particularities. You know, we have everything from Mark written possibly in the 50s, some would say 60s, but everyone agrees Mark was probably first. Everyone agrees John was probably last, somewhere in the 80s, maybe early 90s. Regardless of the way you map it out, everybody pretty much agrees now that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written in the first century at some point. And more than that, no other Gospels other than those four are written in the first century. I can tell you this, in the field of biblical scholarship, a consensus is not easy to get. You take four scholars and stick them in a room, you get four views about just about everything. And by the way, there didn't used to be a consensus about this. If you go back 100 years, there used to be all kinds of ideas that maybe John was a late Gospel and in the second century, and who knows about these other dates, but as more and more evidence has poured in, scholars have been more and more convinced, no, that these are the Gospels, are the earliest ones we have. And every once in a while, a scholar will try to challenge this. They'll try to say, no, maybe there's another Gospel besides our Gospels that are from the first century. And usually it's the Gospel of Thomas. Our friend Muhammad Ali discovered that Gospel. And they think, well, maybe Thomas is first century. So they'll publish a book arguing that Thomas is first century, and the scholarly community looks at it and says, all right, let's have a look. And no, we don't believe that. We're not persuaded by that. And by the way, that's not just conservative scholars. That's not just evangelical scholars. That's scholars of all stripes pretty much reached the consensus that the earliest Gospels we have are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now, if that's true, let me just draw out a couple implications from it before we leave this first point. First, and I think I've already sort of made this point, which is that One implication, obviously, is that if you want to know something about Jesus, you want to get as close to these events as you possibly can from the person who wrote them. And if you want that, then the only options you really have are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And that is just a rule of thumb of all history. But there's another implication that I think is often overlooked in this discussion, and one worth noting here. And this doesn't often dawn on people. But here's the implication. If, in fact, our Gospels are written in the first century, which they were, that means they were written at a time when there were people still alive that had seen these things and had observed these things and had been there. In other words, they wrote at a time when there's people still around that had actually been a part of these historical events. And they could have said, yes, that's how it happened, or no, that's not how it happened. They could have confirmed or denied it. And if you were just fabricating a gospel and making things up, and you wrote that gospel at a time when there were people still around who were there, there's no way your gospel would have gotten out of the gate. Now, of course, someone could say, oh, but that's in the ancient world. People believed anything that was written down. You might think, oh, everyone in the ancient world was gullible. No one thought about what counts as good history in the ancient world. People just believed whatever was on the page. Really? Because when we look at the historical facts, that also doesn't bear itself out. Actually, you might be surprised to know that ancient historians were very picky and very particular about what counts as good history. And they would often critique their fellow historians and fellow historical accounts if they recorded bad history. And one of the things that made something bad history is that you did not interview eyewitnesses, you did not talk to people who were really there, you did not write at a time that was close to the events you're reporting to record. The idea that our Gospels could have been as successful as they were, written in the first century, when in fact there were people alive that could have contradicted them if they were made up, simply doesn't hold. Now, this first point, then, is quite compelling. If someone asks you what's different about your Gospels, you can simply say, well, I'm no biblical scholar, but I know one thing. These Gospels get you closer to the historical Jesus than any other Gospels we have. It's almost like I could stop there. It's like a one-point message. When's the last time you heard a one-point sermon, right? Where's our pastor here? Maybe next week you could preach a one-point sermon. People wouldn't know what to do with themselves, right? It's like no one has a one-point sermon, but in theory you could have a one-point message. You say, look, I don't know a lot about the Gospels, but thank you very much. I'll take the ones that get me closer to the historical Jesus than every other one. They're the only Gospels that get us to the first century. And this is one of the hallmark distinctives of them. Okay, let's move on to a second thing that makes our Gospels distinctive. And that's not just the when question, but now the who question. Who are the authors of these Gospels? You see, it's one thing to have a Gospel that's early, which we do, but it's another thing to have a Gospel written by somebody who has some sort of standing and some sort of access to the things that Jesus said and did. And so here's the second thing that sets our Gospels apart. Our Gospels are the only ones that have a credible connection to the apostles. They're the only Gospels that have a credible connection to the apostles. I want you to think about biographies for a moment. You've probably been in a bookstore and checked out a biography every now and then, or a library, and you maybe noticed that if it's a famous individual, there's lots of biographies written by lots of people about famous individuals. Let's imagine, for example, you wanted to have a biography of Nelson Mandela. So you wanted to know, okay, what was the story of Nelson Mandela? How did he come up, rise through power, his time in prison, his political career, et cetera, et cetera? If you went to the average bookstore, you'd find lots of options to get biographies on Nelson Mandela. But if you looked hard enough, eventually you'd find one with a little phrase on the front. And it would say, authorized biography. Have you ever reflected on that before? What's an authorized biography? Well, obviously, when it comes to someone's life who's famous, anybody could pick up a pen and write about it. That's actually not that distinctive. That happens a lot. But an authorized biography is different because an authorized biography is a situation where the person who's under discussion is actually given someone access to tell their story. Maybe giving them some behind-the-scenes information, giving them access to the archives, access to what happened. And most likely the person who's got the authorized biography is one who's been there and seen these things take place and has some standing to write about them. If you're looking for such a biography about Nelson Mandela, you could find one. It's written by Anthony Sampson, one of Mandela's longtime friends, expert in the politics of South Africa, and who was there to witness many of the things that he ends up recording. So think about it for a moment. If you had a biography of Nelson Mandela that was from, say, Anonymous, or you had a biography of Nelson Mandela from Anthony Sampson and it said authorized biography, which would you pick? Well, you would pick the one that was authorized because you have a credible reason to think I'm getting firsthand, eyewitness, authorized information. Now, think about that for the Gospels for a moment. If you wanted to know about the historical Jesus, it would be really good not just to have a story of Jesus from who knows who, but a story written by the people who were actually there, who were eyewitnesses, and could have been commissioned by Jesus to tell Jesus' story. Is there anybody in the ancient world that fits the bill for that? And the answer is there are. We actually know the names of these individuals. They're called the apostles. They're the original 12. We know their names historically. We know they really lived. And we know that Jesus commissioned them to tell his story. So not only were they eyewitnesses, not only were they there, not only were they Jesus' best friends, but Jesus sent them out and said, I want you to tell my story. Pass along my teachings. Tell what happened. I want you to share that with the world. Now, if you had a choice between a gospel written by one of Jesus' best friends or a gospel that was from Anonymous, which would you pick? Answer, you'd pick one from his best friends who were eyewitnesses on the ground. By the way, I don't know if you've thought about it for a moment. It's one thing to have a gospel written in the first century, which we already talked about, but theoretically you could have a gospel written in the first century that was not written by an eyewitness. But here we're talking about not only having a gospel written in the first century, but written possibly by someone who's actually an eyewitness, who was there, who saw these things, but not just an eyewitness, a commissioned eyewitness. Make no mistake about it, there are many eyewitnesses of the events of Jesus, but not all were authorized to tell his story. So if you wanted the real story of Jesus, you would not want merely an eyewitness, not simply one from the first century, but someone who had been commissioned to tell his story, and the names of those people are apostles. So do we have any reason to think our Gospels are written by apostles, or at least that they have material that comes directly from an apostle? And the answer is we have tremendous amounts of evidence for this. We don't have time in our session tonight to go through each of these individually one by one, all four, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So I'll just give you one example here to drive home how we know these things. Let's take John as an example. Let's imagine you look at the Gospel of John, and at the top of it, it says, of course, the Gospel according to John. And you wonder, well, how do I know that the name attached to this Gospel is actually the person who really wrote it? Yeah, it says it's from John, but how do I know it's from John? How do I know it's from John, the son of Zebedee, one of the 12, who was actually one of Jesus' original followers and eyewitnesses? How do I determine that? Well, actually, there's lots of ways we determine that on historical levels, but let me just mention one. One way we can ascertain whether a book was written by the purported author is to look at the earliest Christian followers and who they thought that book came from. In other words, early patristic testimony about who that author was. We actually have this in spades as it pertains to the Gospel of John. One of the most famous is a second century author by the name of Irenaeus. Maybe never heard of Irenaeus, but he was a massive figure in second century Christianity. And Irenaeus tells us that when you read this gospel, says the gospel according to John, that John is John the son of Zebedee, brother of James, one of the 12 who was with Jesus from the beginning. Now you might think to yourself, well, okay, but why should I believe Irenaeus? Maybe Irenaeus got it wrong. Yeah, that's true. It's possible. So where did Irenaeus get his information from? Almost certainly, we know this, he got it from his mentor, who was a person by the name of Polycarp, who was an earlier church father. So you might ask, well, what makes me think that Polycarp would have gotten that right? Here's what's amazing. You know who Polycarp's mentor was? John himself. So let's just let this sink in for a moment. You have John, the actual historical figure, the son of Zebedee, mentors a guy named Polycarp, who mentors Irenaeus, and Irenaeus tells us that the gospel called John was written by that John, and when Irenaeus tells us that, he's only one person removed from John himself. That's a remarkable historical connection. And after all that, a person could still say, okay, he's only one removed from John himself, but he still could have gotten it wrong. Yep, it's possible. Lots of things are possible historically. But that's not really the question historians ask. We don't ask what's possible, we ask what's probable, we ask what's likely, what's reasonable. Is it likely to think that Irenaeus would have gotten that wrong? Certainly not. And what you realize, we have every good reason to think that John's gospel actually comes from one of Jesus' authorized biographers. By the way, we could do the same thing with Matthew, Mark, and Luke. even though Mark and Luke were not written directly by apostles in the sense that they held the pen, we have every reason to know they go right back straight to one of them. In fact, Mark's tradition comes clearly from Peter himself. When you read Mark's gospel, you're getting effectively Peter's gospel. Every piece of historical evidence points to that fact. So what does that mean? That means our gospels are the only ones that have a credible connection to the apostles. Now, you might wonder, what about these other gospels out there? What about, say, the Gospel of Thomas? It could not possibly have been written by the Gospel of Thomas or by the Apostle Thomas, because the Gospel of Thomas was dated in the second century or later, just like every other gospel was. We talked about that in our first point. That means that there's no other gospel that has a credible connection to the apostles, because no other gospels are from the first century. Now you might wonder, well, why is the Gospel of Thomas called the Gospel of Thomas if it wasn't really written by Thomas? Well, just think about it for a moment. If you're trying to write a gospel in the second century and get a hearing for it, what are you going to call it, right? You're not going to call it Bob's Gospel, right? You're going to come up with some name that people want to hear, some famous person. By the way, have you noticed how many apocryphal gospels we have that are attached to famous names? It's Gospel of Thomas, an apostle, Gospel of Peter, an apostle, Gospel of Mary, a companion of the apostles, Gospel of Judas, an apostle. It just keeps going on and on and on. You can tell in the second century they're grabbing for famous names to try to attach their gospels to. But none of them could go back to an apostle, because all those other gospels are second century or later. Now, those first two points are pretty significant. We have the earliest gospels we have are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the only ones with even a shot to be written by one of Jesus' followers, his authorized biographers. Okay, that leads us to a third thing tonight that sets our gospels apart. Not just the when, and not just the who, but now we turn our attention to the what, if you will. And that is pertaining to content. Here's the third difference. Our canonical gospels lack the legendary embellishments of many later gospels. Our gospels lack the legendary embellishments of many later gospels. One of the things that people don't realize when they read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it's how they tell the story of Jesus in such a restrained, matter-of-fact way. Now, I know you're thinking to yourself, well, it doesn't seem very restrained and matter-of-fact. I mean, aren't the Gospels filled with miracles? Aren't they filled with stories that are hard to believe? Isn't it? Don't they all end with a resurrection? How is that restrained and matter-of-fact? Well, actually, it is restrained and matter-of-fact when you actually look at the broad swath of Gospel writing in early Christianity. Then it becomes very clear why the canonical Gospels sound so tame in the way they tell the story, and actually resist some of the temptations that are so common in storytelling. I'll give you a couple of examples to drive this home. Have you ever noticed that when you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and you read about the resurrection of Jesus, has it ever dawned on you before that when it comes to the story of the resurrection of Jesus, you actually don't have an account in the Gospels that watches and sees Jesus coming out of the tomb alive? You don't actually have anyone positioned as an eyewitness to see Jesus resurrect from the dead and walk out of the tomb. In fact, in the Gospels, all you have is the women showing up early that Sunday morning, and when they get there, the stone is already rolled away, the tomb is already empty, Jesus is gone, they don't see him rise from the dead, he's already risen by the time they get there. Now, if you were making up the Gospels and you were making up the story of Jesus, and the crescendo of your narrative is the resurrection, which it clearly is the crescendo. Everything's been building up to this man rising from the dead. Would you not have positioned some eyewitness there who could have watched it happen and give you effectively a videotape of Jesus coming out of the tomb? That's not what we find in the canonical Gospels. In fact, in the canonical Gospels, the women just show up, the stone's already gone, as if that's kind of what happened. It's a very restrained and matter-of-fact way of telling the story. Now, if you want a gospel that tells you or shows you a videotape, so to speak, of Jesus coming out of the tomb, there's a gospel for you. It's actually called the Gospel of Peter. The Gospel of Peter actually solves that problem, so to speak, in the canonical gospels by making sure there's plenty of eyewitnesses around when Jesus rises from the dead. The Gospel of Peter was not written by Peter as a later apocryphal gospel, but in that story, you can tell the legendary embellishments have started to grow. So that in the resurrection account in the Gospel of Peter, now there's eyewitnesses positioned all around the tomb. In fact, not just eyewitnesses, but all the 12 are there waiting for Jesus to rise. And all the Jewish leaders are waiting for Jesus to rise. All the Roman officials are there waiting for Jesus to rise. So that when he rises from the tomb, all of them are right there to see it happen. And then it goes and beyond that, when Jesus comes out of the tomb in the Gospel of Peter, he's not the Jesus you remember. He's not the Jesus you think you remember, because when he comes out of the tomb in the Gospel of Peter, he's a giant Jesus. He's a Jesus whose head goes further than the clouds in the sky. He's what I tell my students, he's Godzilla Jesus coming out of the tomb. And then more than that, he's flanked by angels who are also giant, huge, massive, heads going all the way to the clouds. And then it gets even more strange, because following Jesus out of the tomb in the Gospel of Peter is the cross itself. That's strange. Usually in the Roman world, when you kill someone, you don't send them home with a cross. Here, have this in your grave. And even if they did, the question in the story is, well, how is the cross following Jesus out of the tomb in the Gospel of Peter? Is it floating? Is it walking? And then things get even weird. The cross starts to talk. So just let this sink in for a moment. You've got, in the Gospel of Peter, obviously all these people ideally positioned to be eyewitnesses with a giant, huge Jesus and a floating, talking cross. And then someone says to you, guys, all Gospels are the same. Really? All Gospels are the same? Is it not obvious that the Gospel of Peter is filling the gaps left by the 12? Or left by the canonical four? Now, here's another thing that you may not have noticed about how restrained and matter-of-fact the stories of our Gospels are. Have you ever noticed how little is told in our Gospels about Jesus as a little kid, as a child? By the way, everyone will be curious about this. No doubt you're curious about this. Do you know in the ancient world, when we hear stories of famous rulers and emperors and Caesars, that there's all kinds of evidence that people sort of retroactively created childhood stories around those people to show how great they were before they became great, to show they are already as a kid exhibiting these amazing traits? In the Greco-Roman world, it was standard fare to embellish and prop up your hero by creating these childhood stories where they were amazing and incredible and dynamic and wonderful. Can you imagine the temptation of the gospel authors to do the same? And when you look at all four gospels, you know how many stories we have of Jesus as a kid? A grand total of one in the Gospel of Luke. And even that, incredibly tame. He's in the temple talking to the teachers of the law. But if you want a story of Jesus as a kid, by the way, there's a gospel for you. It's called the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. By the way, not to be confused with the Gospel of Thomas our friend Muhammad Ali found. The Infancy Gospel of Thomas tells you the story of Jesus as a little boy and has all your questions answered. But when you meet this Jesus in the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, he is a little terror. He is a little kid that you wouldn't want to be around. He is a kid that is so terrorizing this village that basically the people in the village go to Joseph and says, get a handle on your son. You've got to stop him from terrorizing our village. One story in the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, the little boy Jesus, another boy bumps into him and the little boy Jesus is mad and kills the kid on the spot. And then after he kills the kid on the spot and the villager gets mad, he raises the kid from the dead. And there's another story where he violates the laws on the Sabbath by making pigeons in the mud. And then when they challenge him on it, he makes the pigeons real pigeons and they fly away. And there's another story where he flies off the top of roof buildings. This is the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. And someone will tell you, oh, all Gospels are the same. Really? This is not the same historical storytelling. This is not the same type of gospel scenario. What you have is, in our canonical gospels, a remarkably restrained, matter-of-fact way of telling the stories. And these later embellishments show themselves to be simply that, later. After the fact, filling in of the gaps left by the canonical four. Okay, that brings us to the fourth and final thing that I'll mention here. And again, there's more than four that set our gospels apart. And here's that fourth and final thing. Our Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were recognized by the earliest Christians at a very early time. They're recognized as authoritative by the earliest Christians at a very early time. If we want to know what Gospels to read, maybe we could ask the question this way. Which Gospels were the early Christians reading? Which Gospels did they rally around? Which Gospels did they recognize as being the ones that were valid? Now, if you go to a major university religion class, they'll tell you, oh, in the early Christian world, nobody knew what Gospels to read. It was a literary free-for-all. It was the wild, wild west. Everyone's reading whatever they want to read. It was only later, much later, fourth century later, that you have a church council that finally fixes this under the leadership of Constantine and solves the problem. By the way, that whole narrative I just gave you just then, none of that is true, and I'm actually going to deal with that in Sunday school class tomorrow morning. But for our purposes here, this idea that in the literary world of early Christianity that no one knew what gospel to read, once again, is great rhetoric, bad history. Because when we look in the evidence from as early as the second century, it looks like actually Christians did know what gospels to read. If we asked Irenaeus which gospels are there, he doesn't say, well, we're working it out, guys. It's kind of complicated. We're trying to figure out which gospels to read. We'll let you know. No, Irenaeus says, what do you mean what gospels to read? Four, and only four, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. If you go to our earliest canonical list, the Moratorium Fragment, also in the second century, how many gospels? Four, and what are they? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. If you go to Clement of Alexandria, also in the second century, and ask him which gospels you should read, which ones are scripture? Well, four, only four, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the same thing over and over and over again. In fact, the manuscripts bear this out. When we look at manuscripts, when gospels are combined into a single manuscript, we can never find a single instance anywhere where apocryphal gospels and canonical gospels are combined in the same codex. Whenever you find multiple gospels in a manuscript, guess which ones they are? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In other words, when you ask the question of what gospels the earliest Christians are reading, it wasn't a literary free fall. They were quite settled that these were the four, and actually the only four, that Christians should deem as scripture. Okay, what have we been doing here? We've been asking the question that Walter Bauer has raised and that our postmodern world has raised, which is, I guess if you got a lot of different views of Jesus, all of them are equally valid, right? If you have a lot of different gospels, all of them are equally valid, right? You can just pick the Jesus you want to pick. Well, I suppose if you just keep distance from the facts and just want to look at the rhetoric, yeah, I guess it means that. But if you care about history and you care about data and you care about legitimacy of these gospels, what you quickly realize is they're not all the same. Our gospels actually have made it into our New Testaments for a reason. They're the earliest gospels we have. They're the only ones with a historically credible connection to the apostles. They lack the legendary embellishments of the later gospels. And most importantly, they were the ones that the early Christians rallied around from a very early point. Thank you very much. All right, we're going to take just a couple moments after this first session and open it up for Q&A before we take a quick break and move on to session two. So here's your chance. If you want to interact with any of the things I've just laid out, those 4 points, or something else related to the reliability of the Gospels, this is a good chance for you to just raise your hand and we'll take a few minutes to interact. I see we have our microphone man here, so if we need that, we can do it. Yeah, we got a hand over here. Wonderful.
Hello?
Maybe. Just want to make sure that. Is it projecting also?
Huh? No. There it is. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Kruger. I guess my question is related to who do you find in academia or just in the popular understanding, or I don't know, this pops up during Easter season or whatever, the Jesus Seminar and their ilk for decades were kind of the, I don't know, maybe the main cultural force in the Western world behind, you know, propounding or pushing forward these Gnostic Gospels as serious alternatives to the canonical ones. It seems like, I don't know, from a layperson's perspective, their influence has waned over the last couple decades or so, although maybe they, you know, they would still get consulted during Easter season or whatever. But who do you find these days that is throwing into doubt the canonical gospels, either from an academic perspective or from a, you know, a group or movement or whatever it is? Like who is championing these ideas today?
Yeah, great question. So the landscape has changed dramatically. Your read on the Jesus Seminar is correct. If you don't know what the Jesus Seminar is, it's a group of scholars that were formed in the 1980s, and they were sort of the big deal in the 80s and 90s about Jesus scholarship, and they're very radical and very much on the left side of everything. They've waned considerably to the point where they're really not even in play anymore. Certainly Bart Ehrman's work is still out there. I'm going to say more about Dr. Ehrman in the second hour and his impact. Where the landscape is now is, this is going to sound crazy, but it's true, the sort of gospel skeptics now are largely, you know, peddling their wares on YouTube. I can't tell you how many times I get sent YouTube videos from folks who actually have some scholarly credentials who are pushing their critical views of the Gospels on YouTube, and I get sent these all the time in my inbox. Are you going to respond to this guy? Can you respond to this guy? He mentioned you. Will you rebuttal this guy? And I'm like, I guess I got to get on YouTube. I'm a step behind. I'm too busy writing books and forming videos. But yeah, that's where it's happening. And a lot of the college students I interact with are watching these YouTube videos. I think about someone like a Dan McClellan. I think about, there's just so many now that are on there, all of which with some sort of claim to have a PhD, and they are pushing these ideas. Be careful what you watch on YouTube. And there's a lot of good stuff on YouTube, too, and so thankfully. But that's where it's happening today. Great question. Yeah, there's a question here, and I saw another hand back here in the middle. Yeah, you got it. Go ahead.
I could look this up for myself, but yeah. It's just handier to ask you. Where does he place, like Mark, you said 50s, maybe 60s?
Yeah, so Bart would have a pretty traditional view. When I say traditional, I mean as far as secular scholars go. So he would put Mark around 70. He would put Luke and Matthew in the 80s. He'd put John in the 90s. Standard fare. And, you know, there's a few evangelicals that have that view. I think evangelicals typically have Mark pre-70, and often have Matthew and Luke pre-72, but I don't really have a care either way about, you know, a decade here or there on these dates. Ehrman's complaint about the four Gospels even isn't really so much about their dates. He would challenge their authorship, and, you know, we would have to get into the weeds of that. But he would agree, as almost all scholars do, like I said, that they're all first century at some level. John is the last, Mark is the first. Almost everyone agrees about that. You're going to earn your calorie count today, your footsteps, yes.
Could you just give us a summary of how historians have concluded that the non-canonical Gospels are written in the second century and not the first?
Yeah, great question. So if you didn't catch the question, how do we know that these non-canonical Gospels are written in the second century? What's interesting is if you take the Gospel of Thomas, which we've been talking about tonight because of our friend Muhammad Ali, interestingly, Thomas was the Gospel that for a few years, people were trying to shove into the first century, and the rest of the scholarly community was like, we're not convinced. Well, now that all has ended, because a number of years ago, two major works were published on the Gospel of Thomas and its date. These were published by scholars by the name of Simon Gathercole at Cambridge and Mark Goodacre at Duke. And both published their books, I think, in the same year, interestingly, and reached the same conclusion, both of which concluded that the Gospel of Thomas was written at the end of the second century. So that pretty much just settled that. And so now you don't have anyone who's trying to push that anymore. How do they know the Gospel of Thomas is written at the end of the second century? Well, there's a lot that goes into that. But one of the major ways we know about a late date for books like the Gospel of Thomas is, one, you can see that they all know the canonical Gospels and are building off the canonical Gospels and riffing off them and filling the gaps left in them. So that's one way we know they're late. The other way we know they're late is a lot of these late Gospels talk about issues that only popped up in that century. One of the things that's classic in the second century is what is called Gnosticism, although that term is now debated, or Valentinian Gnosticism, which is a distinctively second century phenomenon. So if you have a gospel that is Valentinian, it's not first century. Because Valentinian Gnosticism is second century and not first century. And we have a lot of gospels that do that, including Thomas and the Gospel of Truth and the Gospel of Philip and a lot of the Nag Hammadi collections. So those are some of the ways we know how these gospels relate. Yeah, a couple more questions here before we take our break. Yeah, in the back. You can just speak loudly. Yep.
Behind Luke.
Yeah, so the question was, if Peter's behind Mark, who's behind Luke? This is one of the wonderful things about Luke, is that Luke is the only gospel we have that actually gives us in his opening lines why he wrote, where he got his information from, and what his purpose in writing was. It's called the Lucan Prologue, which is the first four verses, very vastly studied. What does Luke do there? He positions himself as a student of the apostles. In fact, he uses a phrase there in the Greek that basically says, people tend to think of Luke as like an investigative reporter. That's not really the better way to think of it. He's basically, I've been a student of these things. I've been under the 12. And he calls the 12 the eyewitnesses and ministers of the word. He uses the term eyewitnesses and effectively says my gospel is coming from their material. Now, you could argue the question, well, maybe Luke just made that up. Maybe he claimed to be all that and it wasn't that. But we have all kinds of corroborating evidence about that because we know Luke traveled with the apostles in the book of Acts. We know he was mentioned by Paul himself. We know he was a companion of Paul. We have all kinds of different things that make that fit. And so Luke actually is as well positioned as anybody to give you direct apostolic testimony. So if you have him and Mark doing what they're doing, then Matthew and John are actual apostles. I mean, if I'm choosing which gospels I'm going to trust, I'm like, I'll take those four because those are giving me the most direct access I can get to the person of Jesus. Great. We'll do one more question before our break. One more. Yes, right here. Yep. Yeah, I'm always surprised by this. Yeah, people think, okay, so if I'm going to write a gospel about the life and teachings of Jesus, I do that within 6 months of his death. Otherwise, it's no longer trustworthy. I'm like, well, okay. We know our gospel writers probably wrote anywhere from 20 to 40 years after the life of Jesus. Okay, depending on, or 20 to 50 years after the life of Jesus, depending on how you do the math. A good example of a person who did this was John Adams. John Adams gave his work on the Revolutionary War was written about 50 years after the Revolutionary War, before he died. And he was there. He was an eyewitness. And he drew upon his earlier diaries that he took while he was living through those times. And so if you think about John Adams' own writings on the Revolutionary War, they actually mimic our Gospels actually quite well. He actually functions a little bit like John does. Sort of the last living patriarch who gives you his story right before he dies and leans on earlier writings to pull it together. So when we say our gospel authors wrote somewhere between 50 and 90 AD, we're not suggesting that when they wrote, you know, that they never used earlier sources or earlier documents or earlier records that they had kept or what have you, but that the final version of that gospel obviously was written at that time. So it's not like, you know, it was 50 years of oral tradition and then suddenly someone goes, hey, we should write this down. Yeah, why didn't we think of that? We really ought to write this down. I think they were already writing it down, and I think we have good reasons to think that, which I've covered in some of my other books. That's a great question. Now, speaking of writing things down, one of the big challenges of the reliability of the Gospels and the New Testament in general is whether, not just whether it was written down accurately, but whether it was copied accurately. Was it corrupted? Was it changed? Was it edited by scribes? That's what I'm going to talk about when we get back from our break. So who is going to give instructions on the break here? 10 minutes? What are we doing? 5 to 10 minutes. And then I will jump back up here and we will talk about scribal changes. See you shortly. Shock collars. All right.